The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, Keynesians and their half-brother monetarists and big government advocates, they're all begging for the Federal Reserve to announce QE2, you know, the quantitative easing to come out in August at the Federal Open Market Committee. Is that what they're looking for?
Well, August 10th is their next meeting, and the markets would certainly like a little boost, a little shot in the arm, so to say.
It's like a drug addict. It's like, give us just a little bit more.
Just remember, Kevin, quantitative easing, the first round, was focused on mortgage-backed securities and long-dated treasuries. Mm-hmm. The mortgage-backed security market has fallen to pieces, largely because real estate transactions have slowed significantly, and the securitization mechanism that Wall Street was responsible for, their piece, has fallen to pieces as well. No one wants to buy these bundles of mortgages anymore.
Yeah, and but so the government does. The government does.
Well, and that's right. They've stepped into the gap, and rather than have mortgage rates skyrocket, in light of the new risk in the market, as that market faces significant headwinds,
right,
to say the least, they have artificially propped it up, and they've bought a tremendous amount of mortgage-backed securities.
Well, David, that always comes at a cost. I mean, the taxpayer either pays it through taxes or he pays it through reduced value of the spending power of his dollar. So you and I are actually taking on that risk. It's just sort of hidden in a different way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And what is also preventing from occurring, which is very healthy in the context of a recession or even a depression, is a liquidation of bad bets, where you have loans that should never have been made in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it's okay for those to go south or go sour. And if you can only collect pennies on the dollar, or if you collect zero, it's going to hurt someone's balance sheet. Someone didn't invest prudently and wisely, and there is a price to pay for that. That's okay. That's a part of the business cycle. What you do in pushing off that correction in the business cycle is basically make the problem worse for someone down the road, kicking the can down the road, so to say, letting the next generation deal with it.
So you placate the big banks and you placate the people who supposedly were taking the risk. Really, they weren't taking the risk. They were just reaping the reward. It's the taxpayer that takes the risk.
Yeah, we've seen the same thing happen in Europe with the sovereign debt issues, again, where basically banking institutions took on a significant amount of risk, leveraged that risk up, and profited handsomely from it for many years. And then in the context of those bets going against them and beginning to unwind and losses beginning to show, what happens next?
Right.
The governments of those countries, specifically the EU or here in the United States, through TARP, TALF, through the quantitative easing program, which put nearly $1.2 trillion of mortgage-backed securities on the Fed balance sheet, what they did is they shifted the liabilities, rather than liquidate the bad debts, they shifted the liabilities off of individual balance sheets onto the collective balance sheet.
Right.
Now, the Fed bears the burden and has to figure out what to do with the paper. The reason is they want there to be stability in the marketplace, and they know that if you begin to unwind these assets, what happens is it may happen in unruly fashion. If that happens, then you end up with market panic and maybe even a complete destruction of sentiment, if you will, in the marketplace. You've got to be able to unwind that slowly, or at least buy yourself time and take the pressure off of the market, remove the bad assets out of the limelight, and allow there to be a sense of normalcy reemerge into the marketplace.
Well, David, isn't, in a sense, this an avoidance of pain that should be natural? Like, if I were touching a stove right now and it didn't hurt, okay, damage would be being done. I just wouldn't know it. You know, people who've been paralyzed in the past don't feel sometimes the pain that they should feel. Maybe they smell the skin burning. And in this particular case, have we really felt the pain, or are they just actually delaying the pain, but still the damage is being done?
Yeah, I think that's a great concept, Kevin, in terms of the nervous system damage, because Bernanke is basically creating a systemic leprosy where we can't feel and yet there is a negative effect, and yet we don't know it, and we can't see it, and the numbers don't show it because it's been obscured. The Fed balance sheet has been a critical thing for that, and of course the Treasury would be a backstop for the Fed, according to a number of monetary historians. But the issue is real damage is being done, structural damage within the context of the financial markets. Mm-hmm. The securitization system is broken. Volumes are off anywhere from 40 to 60% and not in the process of recouping. The monetary transmission mechanism is not functional today. It's not a question, in my opinion, of whether or not it could be impaired. It is impaired. It's not working.
Right.
The velocity of money has collapsed. The M1 money multiplier has collapsed. M3 has collapsed. These things are pretty unprecedented. And the question is the environment getting better? Is there a natural place from which we can step forward into a new era of growth after the bad bets have been unwound? And this is the problem, is we're not allowing that to happen.
Well, you know, David, with dollars not changing hands, you were talking about the velocity of money. M3, the velocity of money, the amount that a dollar changes hands in a year. Okay, that's velocity. That's fallen off the cliff. It's just not happening. And I saw an article right here in our local paper yesterday that was saying it's the rich's fault. The rich, anybody who makes more than $220,000 a year, seems to be saving money and not spending what they should. I mean, that's pure Keynesian nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, you need to get out there and do your civic duty and spend like there's no tomorrow. But by the way, if you do cross that $250,000 barrier, we're also going to tax the living daylights out of you. So holding back and saving some money aside because you don't know what the impact of taxation is going to be into your total financial picture, that's not prudent. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario.
Right.
We're going to tax you, and we expect you to spend everything that you get.
It's always the rich's fault. They're either not spending enough money or not paying enough in taxes.
Right, yeah. Right. You're exactly right, Kevin. There's an interesting undercurrent of blame shifting, mm-hmm. and the easiest people to blame are a crowd, if you will, that has no particular face.
Right.
So the rich, who is that exactly? This is the same kinds of things that you see with nascent xenophobia, where it is a race. It's not a particular individual that you may have a problem with. It's an entire race mm-hmm. that you have a problem with.
Right.
And when there is a dissettling or a disquieting at the social level, you do start to see fingers pointed. And it's not to individuals who can claim or take responsibility. It's to these amorphous groups.
Right.
And the only way to deal with that is with large policies which impact and put this group in its place.
Well, you know, David, we were talking about the avoidance of pain because in reality, okay, we haven't really felt. We've talked about a slowdown, and yes, we have high unemployment. Those people who've lost their jobs have truly felt pain, but they don't make up yet a large enough block of the economy or a large enough block of the voting group necessarily to say the whole nation has felt tremendous pain. When this pain comes, I mean, as far as setting these pins up to be knocked down, you were talking about this amorphous group or this faceless group. That pin is being set up to be knocked down. It's going to be taxed. It's going to be attacked. I'll bring somebody else up. And this we've seen in the German Weimar Republic in the past when the Jews were blamed because a lot of the Jews had gold and diamonds and got through the early 1920s fairly intact when a lot of the German nationals at that same time were in the paper currency that collapsed. Will we see the person who's actually walking away unscathed or whole blamed as this thing starts to show up in pain?
Well, I think that's very reasonable. Kevin, I wanted to point out some things from this last week, which I thought were pretty significant. The Congressional Budget Office gave an appraisal, and I thought a very honest one, a straightforward one.
Well, that's a rarity.
Well, it just pointed to the growing budget deficits and the lack of income to support them were going to be an issue in the future.
Well, that's good. I'm wondering when they should have actually said that. Which decade?
Well, and this is an issue. Many economists are a day late and a dollar short. Mm-hmm. Brilliant in their own right, but either looking too far back or too far forward and not exactly connected with the present tense.
Right.
It was Nassim Taleb last week who said, essentially, government debt is becoming a pure Ponzi scheme. What broke Madoff is going to break governments. They need to find new suckers all the time. And unfortunately, the world is running out of suckers. Kevin, you just have to wonder, or at least I do, if there's not an end game on the horizon in the Treasury market, where, again, all these things are based on certain assumptions. The stability within the Treasury market, the stability within the dollar market, they are based on the assumption that the dollar will remain the reserve currency of the world. it's dependent on the idea that the Fed will do the right thing at the right time in terms of monetary policy. Mm-hmm. It's dependent on fiscal policy being reasonable and us not spending more than we're supposed to, that our deficits actually are normal compared to the revenues that we're bringing in, normal somehow defined. Those assumptions are the ones that are being called into question. That's not sort of a future tense issue. The dollar has been under pressure for the better part of 10 years. The competency of the FOMC can reasonably be called into question, because in the context of a 2002-2003 deflationary morass, what are they doing? They're lowering rates to zero and causing the next misallocation of capital, fueling the real estate bubble, which ultimately has burst and led to another crisis, in their opinion, a very deflationary crisis. And this is an interesting bias at the Fed currently, is that we are in or on the cusp of a massive deflationary trend. Well, guess what that means? It means that they have to accommodate with low interest rates.
Right.
It means that they have to accommodate with quantitative easing. It means that they have to accommodate with all kinds of new realities. You bring all the tools out of the toolbox.
Well, and what tools are there, Dave? I mean, let's face it. You've got the lowering of interest rates. You've got the printing of money. That money velocity is just almost at zero. I mean, it's just crashed. If you print a lot of money and it doesn't go into the system, you've talked about this before, it builds up like a dam, okay, water behind a dam. Something could trigger that money all hitting the system at once. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars that are not moving right now but are still out there. What other tool does the Fed have? What other mechanism does it have to try to stimulate an economy that's just not restarting?
Well, this is exactly what we had in Switzerland this last year, Kevin. The Swiss National Bank was directly intervening in the currency markets, mm-hmm. and that was one alternative. The year before, the Swiss monetized corporate paper as well.
Right.
So, I mean, what can go onto the Fed balance sheet? Virtually anything.
Yeah.
Where is the next crisis? Is it in municipal bonds? Is it because localities and municipalities are having a hard time paying their bills? Just this last week in East St. Louis, they decided to not make a $500,000 payment because they realize that nobody's got a gun to their head. No right. one can force them to make a payment. It's the first round of default, and they're just basically going to their creditors and saying, you'll have to wait.
Well, and let's
we have bills to pay.
They don't have the money.
The point is that the Fed can come in, and wherever there is a crisis, they can play cleanup and use their balance sheet as a nasty mop bucket and just pick up all the scraps off the floor that no one else particularly wants or cares for. I mean, this is the mortgage-backed securities market that nobody wanted, and they absorbed. It's the long end of the Treasury curve, which right. would be indicating a very different economic picture if rates were, in fact, at 5.5% or 6% or 6.5%. And instead, they're closer to 4%. Does manipulation of the long end of the curve mean anything to any of our listeners?
Right.
It should. But this is the open market operations.
Well, and it's the auto company that's about to go out of business. It's the too big to fail banks that are just about to go out of business. So you're right. It all comes out on the balance sheet. The problem is we're riding on a false premise long term that the dollar will always stay a reserve currency. You were talking about a Ponzi scheme earlier. I mean, is the dollar a Ponzi scheme where you always have to have a new sucker, like a chain letter? You always have to have that next person out there to be able to come in. Now, David, what happens when we run out of people who are willing to buy dollars?
The question is, what else are they going to buy?
Right.
We know that the euro is not the greatest. We know that the yen is not big enough to accommodate global inflows. We know that the Swiss franc is also too small a currency to accommodate global foreign currency traffic, the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars every day that goes through the foreign currency markets. So the best argument for the dollar remaining the world's reserve currency is that it doesn't have any competition.
Unless gold becomes competition.
It could be, but it's a little bit like saying the U.S. will maintain its status as the place where the greatest education can be gotten here, whether it's science, whether it's math, whether it's... And you begin to realize that it's actually a very competitive environment, mm-hmm. and that you can go to Mumbai and Beijing and dozens of countries, whether it's in Asia, in Africa, in Europe, and there are competitive programs, and there are highly intelligent people, brilliant people who are competing in the workforce. The assumption that an Ivy League education or, you know, the maths and the sciences, again, are something that we dominate here in the United States, No. And that, for a long time, that was the case that was made, is that no one can compete with us. Well, we have the best educational system.
Then let's talk about paradigm shift again. It's been a couple of years since we've talked about it, but Thomas Kuhn wrote a book, and it talked about paradigm shifts and how long the science community or various academic communities go on a wrong model, a model that's actually been disproven by later research, but still operating on the flat earth model or the sun revolving around the earth. Those models sometimes take a century to break the stronghold in the mind.
Well, what's interesting is that there is a discrediting which may take a century to occur, but the breaking of the model and the switch of the model happens almost instantaneously.
Does that cause a panic then for those who are on the wrong premise?
Yeah, we've got the world largely run by Keynesians and monetarists, and particularly the Keynesians. They're the most popular school of thought. And the issue is the world works a certain way, according to the Keynesians, and these are your dominant writers and thinkers in Washington, your policy wonks. I mean, these are the guys who have very educated opinions,
right?
But not opinions that are necessarily tied into reality.
Well, they may work with certain formulas, certain models on certain calculators, but the problem is, in the real world, those models can break down. I mean, we're talking about a Keynesian, let's face it, is a guy who says, the more you go broke, the more you need to spend. I mean, that's one simplicity towards how you come out to be a Keynesian. This is why the government loves the Keynesians, because, yeah, the more you go broke, just print more money. It's the touching the stove things. Keep your finger on the stove. We'll just take away the pain.
What both the Keynesians and monetarists fail to appreciate, Kevin, is that while the Fed can create liquidity, coming back to monetary policy, while the Fed can create liquidity, they cannot direct its flow. And this is why credit bubbles or excess money, when it's created, it's ultimately going to wreak havoc somewhere in some way. Now, wreaking havoc is also going to create an artificial wealth on the one hand. I mean, there's a lot of people who saw their house double in price from 2004 to 2008 and then watched it drop 30% off of its peak, or 30 or 40 or 50% off its peak if you were unfortunate enough to live in Southern California or Nevada or Florida or what have you. This is the issue we've stated repeatedly, Kevin. It's the issue of creating too much liquidity, creating even more debt obligations to bail yourself out of a bad debt obligation to begin with. The best you're doing is buying yourself time. The best you're doing is buying yourself time. And if circumstances don't play themselves out just right, you're ultimately going to crack the system in a much more painful way.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, if you look at our debt levels 10 years ago, in the municipal market, it's doubled in the last 10 years. If you look at the federal level, the last 10 years have been devastating in terms of our balance sheet, the U.S. balance sheet. What has happened to our national debt? We're pressing $14 trillion. You know, this is ultimately unsustainable. And what we're going to try to do is claim that the next move from $14 trillion in debt to $28 trillion in debt is not going to be a big deal either.
Right.
You know, or the municipalities can double down from here and increase their debt load. No, ultimately, we're dealing with a cash flow problem. There's not enough revenues to meet the outstanding obligations. And if you don't have an expansion of credit, if that doesn't continue, and it has not continued over the last 2 years, then guess what? It's game time. Yeah. You're watching the clock, and it's ticking down to the last few seconds. We have a municipal crisis right in front of us. As we look at the data, we see a significant problem with treasuries on the horizon. And this is not just us, Kevin. I mean, this is a global theme, but people are lining up on the wrong side of things. You know, people are taking much more risk. They're moving to lower quality paper. They're moving to junk bonds. They have over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
We've seen the greatest, as we mentioned last week or the week before, the greatest inflows into municipal bond market funds in the first half of this year in history.
Well, and you brought out, it makes sense on one side of the equation, but it's completely wrong. It's the wrong time to jump into the Titanic. Because, you know, on one sense of the equation, you've got people saying, all right, under this Obama administration, we are going to have higher taxes. So let's go ahead and get into something that's going to give us some income without taxes. But it really is like going on an iceberg watching expedition on the Titanic. Yeah, you'll see icebergs, but do you really want to be on that boat?
Yeah, the desire for the Keynesians and monetarists to see a second round of quantitative easing, Kevin, this is what launches us towards inflation.
Mm-hmm.
We're already seeing inflation in Australia and in Russia and in India and in China, in the UK, in Brazil, in Thailand, in Korea, in Malaysia, and in a whole host of other countries. But they are tightening monetary policy aggressively in the face of inflation. Our Fed is far more concerned with a 1930s-style deflation at this point, and they may very well add more fuel to the fire, thinking that it's deflation ahead of us, and we've got to do everything we can to bail ourselves out of that. I mean, we've used the analogy before, deflation is a little bit like a dead horse.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat it to get it up off the ground. Whereas inflation, their assumption is you can always rein it in.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. There's another thing that they're considering, and I know you've done a lot of research and read prominent economists that have gone back, monetary historians, that have gone back and looked at what is the original mandate of the Fed, which is price stability, versus what seems to be the mandate of the Fed right now, which is unemployment as well. I mean, the Federal Reserve, as long as unemployment is high and continues to rise, if they keep monetary policy loose to try to solve that unemployment problem or take away the pain, history has proven that that turns into an inflationary mess. We saw that back in the 60s, how it carried over into the 1970s when gold went to $850 an ounce.
This week we had a fascinating conversation with Michael Bordeaux. He's professor at Rutgers University and a monetary historian, teaches economics and monetary history there. He's a visiting professor at Cambridge, a visiting professor at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and contributes regularly to the National Bureau of Economics Research. I've benefited greatly from reading his articles and his papers. The data collection is fantastic.
Right.
And so it's filled in a number of gaps for me in that regard.
They are always looking at both inflation and expected inflation, but they also look at unemployment and output gaps. And often the second type of variable that they look at, which is unemployment or full employment, often dominates their concern over inflation. In work that I've done with a colleague here at Rutgers, we found that in most recessions in the post-war, in the beginning of the recovery stage, that the Fed often waited too long, that it spent a lot of time worrying about unemployment, that perhaps it was under some political pressures because unemployment was high and lingering, and so they waited too long. And then when they realized that the economy was recovering quite well and that there was now a beginning of inflationary pressures, they would then put on the brakes, and they would often put it on a bit too hard.
Which is an interesting observation, Kevin, because it is unemployment that dominates the landscape today,
mm-hmm.
and inflation, which is a very secondary concern, with the assumption being that they can always rein that in later, if it's an issue at all. And I think one of the first things I would say, just in comment to Michael Bordeaux, is that we are not definitively in a recovery. So theoretically, this makes sense in terms of launching us into an inflation by remaining over-accommodative too long,
right,
overstaying your welcome with those monetary policies, the accommodative policies. But we're not in a recovery.
Right.
And this is where certain confidence in the numbers generated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, even by the NBER, they're not necessarily real time. I mean, if you look at the definition of a recession by the NBER, they generally make a proclamation of the beginning or an ending of a recession 1 to 3 years after it has occurred.
Right.
So it is very much a look back, and which is very helpful if you're doing research at a later point and want a snapshot, a definitive capture, if you will, of the data. But in real time, it doesn't help you one bit.
Well, you know, David, Professor Bordeaux has spent many years talking about how when the Federal Reserve starts to merge over into government concerns, which in his opinion, unemployment is a government concern. When the Federal Reserve starts looking at that and starts trying to manage unemployment down, and I'll just add my own little side on this, it is an election year. We've seen the Federal Reserve operate differently every election year virtually. And when they start looking at unemployment, and they start saying, okay, do we do QE2, which gives them more money?
It's a compromise of independence.
There you go.
It's an absolute compromise of independence.
Which the Federal Reserve is supposed to be independent of the U.S. Treasury.
Right. So not only do we have them working directly with the Treasury, crossing over into fiscal issues, becoming the final vote as to who wins and loses. I mean, it's almost like a Roman circus. Mm-hmm. Is it a thumbs up? Yes, you get the credit. Or a thumbs down? No, you're going into insolvency.
Yeah.
I mean, they have become the Roman emperor, if you will, determining life and death in the credit markets. That really wasn't the intention, whether it's price stability, looking at inflation, if they ease over into focusing on unemployment. There's a lot of ways that they can operate and priorities that they can have. But beyond the shadow of a doubt, today they are an enmeshed organization, enmeshed with the Treasury, enmeshed with D.C. at a variety of levels. And that is, as you point out, Kevin, not necessarily Bordeaux's opinion, but ours, that this is unhealthy in an election year.
Well, and Professor Bordeaux said that this is not the first time it's happened. There are historic examples of when the Federal Reserve does that, it turns into inflation.
Right. Johnson was a classic. He loved to push his weight around and basically would call over to the FOMC and bark his orders. I mean, there's just no, you know, it's my way or the highway, boys.
Well, on the press, he publicly criticized the Federal Reserve. So they got weak-kneed. I think it was two or three Fed, it was at least two Fed chairmen that got weak-kneed for that period of time that Johnson was pushing his weight around.
Well, again, why are we discussing the FOMC? Why are we discussing where we're at today, which, quite frankly, is at an interesting monetary intersection or crossroads? We've seen unprecedented policies put in place to help the economy along with the intention of moving us towards full recovery. We may be in recovery. We don't think so. But if we are in recovery, then we are potentially going to see a double-dip recession. And as we look at the recent GDP figures, of note is the revision downward for 2007, 2008, and 2009, all with a deeper and more structurally damaging consequence than originally thought or originally calculated. And the Fed is deeply concerned with lingering unemployment. They're suspicious of deflation, and that's certainly a bias held by Bernanke, given his educational background. Is the Fed haunted so much by a specter of the 1930s deflation that they're going to end up inadvertently throwing us into an inflation or hyperinflation?
Well, and let's face it, from an educational background, I mean, Bernanke was obsessed with how the 1930s depression could have been avoided with the application of liquidity. So his running the Fed right now is really a playing out of his thesis statement as for his doctoral work.
Well, right. Quantitative easing is just one of the many tools, lowering rates to zero. I mean, the speech in 2000 was being a little bit facetious and saying we'll drop money from helicopters. Mm-hmm. But the point is, there is no limit as to what the Fed can do. And that came out in our conversation with Michael Bordeaux as well. We basically said, we can get away with it.
Because we're reserve currency.
Let's go to that. Well, looking at short-term rates, you know, and again, the question of low inflation or deflation. Short-term rates are not the only tool of the Fed. If we were in a low inflation or deflationary environments, low rates would be ineffective, but what non-conventional measures might be employed? Foreign currency intervention, quantitative easing on even a larger scale. And if it was on a larger scale, what types of assets could they include? Do we have any sort of historical reference point for that?
In other words, you're saying if the recovery is not forthcoming and we were still more worried about a recession, what can we do right now, given that we have low interest rates? What the Fed can do is more quantitative easing. It can buy more long-term treasuries. It can buy mortgage-backed securities. Today, they're talking about using the proceeds from debt, the interest proceeds on bonds that they've already purchased, and using that to purchase more bonds. So they can do that. There are a number of other things they can do if they want to encourage the economy. They can lower the interest that they pay on excess reserves to encourage bank lending. There's no limit to what a central bank in a country which has a reserve currency and which does not have major, major concerns about its credibility, about how much money it can print. Okay, that isn't an issue. The Fed can really juice up the economy a lot if they want to.
Yeah, but I guess that's my point. In that last comment, the Fed can do whatever they want.
If
they have reserve currency status
and if
no credibility concerns, those are two rather big ifs. And clearly there's not an alternative to the dollar as a reserve currency today, but there is an intention globally to see that. And even the folks, you know, Barry Eichengreen, this last year in Foreign Affairs magazine, looked very carefully in an article on the U.S. dollar at how the singular nature of the dollar-based monetary system that we have today was a thing of the past, and that central banks around the world want a way out. This is Foreign Affairs.
Yeah.
This is Barry Eichengreen, a very significant economist in his own right out at Berkeley, a contemporary of Michael Bordeaux. They've co-written articles together. The dollar reserve currency status, whether it is substituted with what we've talked about before, a basket of other currencies, a basket of currencies and commodities, that was the old Keynesian idea, is that there would be a basket of commodities that we base our currency system on. There's a number of options which I don't think are fully appreciated today, and certainly here in the United States, we just assume. We assume that things will be tomorrow exactly what they were today and yesterday.
Well, and you know, the other if, we had the first if we are a reserve currency, which really allows us to, I hate to say it, David, abuse the system.
And frankly, I think we will be a reserve currency. It's the question, and this is how important an article is, a reserve currency versus the reserve currency.
Yes, but the other if is credibility of balance sheet. I mean, that was another thing that Professor Bordeaux was saying. You know, as long as we maintain credibility of balance sheet, we're fine.
But that's the issue. That's the point. Not only is our balance sheet bust today, but we're adding not only future contingent liabilities as time goes on, but we're talking about funding between $1 and $2 trillion this year in deficit. Next year, maybe we get a grip on our fiscal deficits 3, 4, 5 years from now, but there's no guarantee that we will. On top of that, we've got the pressures of bailing out the municipals just around the corner.
Right.
We've got the continued unwinding of the mortgage-backed security market and the commercial mortgage-backed security market. All of these pressures end up trickling down onto our collective balance sheet.
Yeah.
And this is the issue. Credibility is absolutely at stake. He identifies number one and number two, the two things that we need in order to maintain the current system.
These are the two pillars.
We have to have the reserve currency status, and we have to maintain credibility. You lose credibility, and guess what you also lose? You lose confidence, and that is the point. We move from a relatively stable currency regime to a broken system and something that looks like Weimar Germany in a very short period of time, and not as a result of the money mandarins controlling policies, but people saying, we don't trust you, and you've lost credibility.
So if we do have the paradigm shift, people need to be prepared. Now, there was a good statement that he made as far as the reserve currency status. He says, really, David, what else do people have to buy? And I think there's an answer to that question. It doesn't have to be the euro. It doesn't have to be the yen. I mean, there's real estate out there. Right now, real estate may be overvalued. There's real estate in the form of gold, silver, platinum, palladium, copper, the commodities, those types of things. Ultimately, even if we have a little bit of a deflationary pressure right now, ultimately those things will be far more valuable than a has-been reserve currency that's got too much debt behind it. Won't that be the case?
I think it's a growing trend, certainly amongst individual investors, and we've seen even greater institutional interest. Even this last week, the University of Texas made a significant purchase, over $500 million in gold. So you're looking at institutions as well as individuals who are saying to themselves, you know, maybe just as a commodity diversification, and they will come to realize that it's not a commodity at all. It is the first currency of choice.
Yeah, you know, David, for years I've been talking to people about holding four fingers up so that you can see where the real money goes. I mean, let's say the index finger is the dollar, okay? And if it's not in the dollar, it's in the next finger, which is the euro, okay? And if it's not in the euro, then it can be in one of the Asian currencies, even though those are not commonly traded. You know, your ring finger can be the Asian currencies. But when those currencies are all in a deficit position or people need out, the pinky finger, the smallest allocation actually out there, or the smallest supply out there, is gold. But it is money. And that's the way gold's been behaving.
And we'll continue to have the arguments against gold as a significant part of our formal monetary system because it's argued it's expensive to maintain. And it's argued that the gold standard is highly inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
And our argument is simply this. It will remain an anachronism and something that is irrelevant to the monetary system until people demand a certain sort of order and structure that is outside the realm of the money mandarins. And it requires a certain sort of...
A certain sort of discipline, David.
Well, right. Inherent to the gold system was a discipline, and that is what they view as inefficiency today. The discipline of the gold standard, something that in itself was inherently stable. That's interesting. John Cairns was a British political economist over 100 years ago, and he looked at that expansion of the gold supply, and it took over 20 years as the expansion of gold supply occurred to see a global increase in prices. And so there was an inflation that occurred, but it was not an instant and overnight inflation, and there was a greater degree of stability. It was by no means perfect, but it was better by far.
Well, David, one of the things that I'd like to do is just bring up again that you're going to be in San Francisco on August 19th through the 21st, and then again in New Orleans in October 27th through the 30th. And so we would encourage anyone listening that would like to meet with you or hear you live or just be around an environment where these things are being discussed to give us a call at 800-525-9556 and ask for Karis. I know the topic that you're going to be speaking on is why gold will hit $5,000.
We'll be talking about five issues among 500 that we could discuss.
Yeah. Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.